Before I introduce today's speaker, I would like to begin with a prayer that was written in honor of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whose life and legacy we celebrated this past Monday. May you be jolted from your comfort zone. May you be an agitator for good. May you stand up for what's right, even and especially when it costs you something. May you commit to move beyond the photo op and soundbite of racial justice work. May you keep going even when your feelings get hurt. May you never settle for quiet when it's peace we seek after. May you know you are not alone. There are plenty of faithful people on this journey. And may you remember the God of all humanity is with you in an unrelenting pursuit for justice. Amen. It's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, the very Reverend Gary Hall. Gary has had a distinguished career as an Episcopal priest, which you can read in detail on our website, which culminated in his serving as the 10th Dean of the Washington National Cathedral, a position from which he retired. Not long thereafter, Trinity Episcopal Church reached out to Gary to serve as our interim rector. As I recall Gary telling the story, he went to discuss it with his wife, Kathy, and she was, shall we say, less than enthusiastic, having looked forward to enjoying their retired life together. She took a deep breath and asked where the position was located. Santa Barbara, Gary replied. Well, responded Kathy, when do we start? Thanks very much to your wife, Gary. It was my privilege and pleasure to serve on the vestry while Gary was serving as our interim rector. We benefited greatly from his warmth, his wit, and his wisdom in our meetings and all his interactions with parishioners and staff, and most especially with his sermons. He served us during a challenging transition period, and all these qualities and more helped us navigate them successfully. I am so grateful, Gary, as a member of the Word and Life Steering Committee and on a personal basis, that you accepted our invitation to participate in this series. We had a tradition when we were meeting in person to welcome our speakers with a blessing. And we began doing this again last week in memory of Tom Heck, who was a longtime member of the Word and Life community and our steering committee. Tom used to lead us in chanting the blessing each week, and I would like to invite Christine Mill to chant it for us today.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
Nice to have her participate.
Thank you so much. I actually, some of you may remember that I spoke to this group in that fabulous Presbyterian space in Santa Barbara in 2017 when you were studying Richard Rohr's book on the Trinity. And I remember having just a wonderful morning with you and really enjoying it. So when Michael reached out to me, I was happy to say yes immediately. This is not my first encounter with John Philip Newell's work. My last thing I did as Dean of Washington National Cathedral was lead a pilgrimage to Iona in 2016. And I actually still have, if you go to Iona, you go to the beach, you can pick up these things they call Iona's Tears. Apparently we walked with this guy who could see them. I could never see them, but he would like say, oh, there's one. And so he got this for me. And apparently, if you have one of these, you're never supposed to die by drowning. So, so far, so good. It's been 5 years and 6 years, and I haven't drowned yet. So, but I love my time in Iona. If I were more technically sophisticated, I would have put one of my 8,000 photographs that I took in Iona up as my Zoom background, but I didn't get around to it this morning. In that year, we were actually, John Philip Newell was going to lead that pilgrimage, and then he got sick. He's fine now. I saw him last week, but he had to back out. And so somebody said, well, you need to do it. And so I remember on the plane to Glasgow reading his books, you know, trying to speed read John Philip Newell's books on Celtic Christianity and do a kind of a cram to understand Celtic Christianity and Celtic spirituality from his writing. Since then, I've actually read them a little more slowly and taken them in. But I have great respect for his scholarship and his leadership there in Iona. And one of my great challenges in my life was leading a mixed group in Iona. Half of the people there were members of National Cathedral, and half of them were former parishioners from All Saints Pasadena. And so I had real progressive Christians were half the group, and real traditional Christians were the other half of the group. And it was an interesting experience in trying to come to some sort of a common ground. I agree with John Philip Newell about almost everything, except I'm still a priest in the Episcopal Church. I still say the Nicene Creed on Sundays with with intellectual integrity. I still think there's a lot of liberating power in the tradition, but I understand and have respect for his decision to move out of the Christian tradition because of the ways it has excluded theological truths that it long suppressed from other parts of our community. I certainly understand, having served at the National Cathedral, how the institutional church can be co-opted by empire. There is always this tension within the Christian tradition between, are we going to be the servants of the established order, or are we going to be agents of a countercultural vision that proclaims something else? It seems to me, as a follower of Jesus, that what Jesus was really finally about, and I kind of really take this from John Dominic Crossan and the scholars in the Jesus Seminar, is that Jesus came among us, came to Jewish Palestine at a time when it was governed by, colonized by the Roman Empire. And if you were a Jewish Palestinian Jew in Jesus's day, you were poor because you were taxed beyond all possible burden to support that standing army. And you were hungry because there wasn't enough food to go around, because all the food was going to feed that standing army. And one of the ways I understand Jesus's ministry is showing that there is a way to live an abundant life, even in the middle of oppression and deprivation, by coming together and founding a new kind of community. And that seems to me what Jesus's ministry is about, and what his teaching is largely about. And in that sense, Christianity at its best always represents what we might call anti-imperial values. And we've had to struggle, really, in my lifetime, to come out from under the shadow of our sort of 1,500-year captivity as the established religion of Western culture. One of the liberating things about being a Christian is that we are no longer that. Western culture has all kinds of other isms that guide us, but the Christian tradition is really now much more a gathered kind of resistance community to imperial values than it was for centuries. The downside of that, of course, is that we're getting smaller. People aren't joining us in the way they were because there's really nothing in it. There's really nothing in it for you anymore to be a Christian in terms of your social or economic standing. You're not going to get a better job or a better admission to the country club because you belong to the church. And so the tensions in the church now still are those tensions about reclaiming our kind of prophetic, gathered, countercultural nature, which I think Newell and this reclamation of Celtic spirituality are about. The tensions between people that see Christianity that way and the people that still see us as the kind of upholder of traditional values. You know, we're the people that are supposed to tell you to, you know, clean your plate and keep quiet in the library and not jaywalk and all that other stuff. I gave all those things up long ago, but there are still people that feel that that's what the church ought to be about. One of the ways to understand and have our way into this chapter about Pelagius, a man I always was told was a heretic and whose ism was a dirty word. I mean, to accuse someone of being a Pelagist, a Pelagianism, was really kind of a dirty word in even up until recent times. One of the ways I understand that is to just say a little bit about this kind of tension in Christianity between what a professor of mine in seminary used to call the rigorists, those who think that following Jesus is about a very rigorous style of living, and the laxists, those who feel that the Christian community ought to include both the wheat and the tares and everyone in between. In the early days, you might say that the first, again, this is a John Dominic Crossan insight, argument within Christianity is visible in the Gospels, and it's the argument between what Crossan calls the itinerants and the householders. In other words, it's clear that Jesus's first followers were itinerants, were people that just followed him from place to place, and there are all those things that Jesus says about the Son of Man has no place to lay his head and go out and without a staff or a sack or whatever and follow me. That Jesus's first followers were itinerants. And then as Christianity basically matured, people that were what Crossan called householders wanted to join, you know, people with jobs and families and roofs over their head. And so the first kind of early question in Christianity was, could a householder be a Christian? Could a person with a mortgage be a Christian? To be a Christian, did you have to drop everything and follow Jesus on the road? And the church decided that question in favor of the householders, in favor of a kind of comprehensiveness. And in some ways, you could say the rigorists lost that fight, but and the laxists won it. And in some sense, all of the arguments in Christianity since then have been arguments between rigorists and laxists, between people who say that the church is essentially the body of the saved, and that there's a very high set of standards by which you can be in the church, and others who say, no, the church is the community of people who want to be in it, and the final judgment will be made, you know, at the end of things. And so you can see that in some ways with monasticism starts out as a bunch of people going out into the desert and being hermits and, you know, and living a very ascetic lifestyle. And eventually the church incorporated those people into letting them be monastic orders. In the same way, what happened in Britain, and this really directly involves the Celts, you know, Christianity came to Britain through Rome. And and then the Celts, and the Celts became Christian. And then the Celts sort of were moved out by the Anglo-Saxons to what they call the Celtic fringe, Wales, Ireland, and Scotland, and Cornwall. And there were two versions of Christianity. And then the Anglo-Saxons came back in and brought Roman Christianity back in when the Normans invaded and in 1066. And then for a while, you had two kinds of Christianity in the British Isles. You had Celtic Christianity, which was kind of the earlier version of Christianity. And then you had Roman Christianity, which was the more imperial style of Christianity. And there was a synod of Whitby in 664, and Hilda, who was the great abbess of Whitby and one of the first women to really exercise ecclesiastical authority, Hilda presided over this synod. And it was technically over things about the date of Easter and how confession would be done. But it basically ended up deciding that Britain would follow Roman Christianity and that Celtic Christianity sort of lost. And Celtic Christianity lost everywhere, of course, but in Ireland. And so in some ways, the tradition that the Irish monks who, St. Columba was, it's Columba's tears rather than Iona. These are Columba's tears. St. Columba, who founded Iona, was an Irish monk, and they sort of reestablished a kind of Celtic Christianity in the northern part of Britain. So there's been this argument within British Christianity, really for 1500 years now, about whether we're going to follow Celtic Christianity, which, as John Philip Newell says, has a much more nature-based, a much more positive view of human nature, or if we're going to follow the Roman system, which has a much more pessimistic vision of human nature, and really was historically not very friendly to the earth, or very interested in the stewardship of the earth's resources. We lost a lot when we decided to suppress Celtic Christianity in the British Isles. We lost a unitary way of seeing the cosmos. Celtic spirituality didn't make distinctions between sacred and secular. It didn't make distinctions between divine and human. The Romans thought in categories. So that's one of the problems with something like the Nicene Creed. The Nicene Creed is written in kind of Roman intellectual speak. And the Romans thought in terms of hard and fast categories, as did the Greeks. And so when they talk about God being divine and human, and being three persons and one substance in the Trinity, that is all very technical Roman ways of seeing the world in these kind of hard and fast categories. The Celts didn't see things in those divisions. They didn't buy into those dualistic ways of seeing things. For Romans, the Trinity, the doctrine of the Trinity, was kind of a philosophical abstraction. For the Celts, and you really get this in Richard Rohr's book, the Trinity was a series of relationships between the three persons of the Trinity, very different way of understanding. So we lost that whole unitary way of seeing things. We lost the kind of direct connection to the non-human world. The Romans were very worried. They had been pagans. They had worshipped trees and rocks and deities in nature deities. And Roman Christians were very worried about a kind of a return to paganism. And so they shut off, they condemned any kind of nature spirituality as idolatry. And in doing that, we lost a direct connection to nature, and we bought into this sense that nature is there for us to exploit. what is the great thing Desmond Tutu said, you know, when the Westerners came to Africa, they had the Bibles and we had the land. And when they left, we had the Bibles and they had the land. It's the same way. I mean, we had this Western tradition of exploitation, largely because we boxed out any kind of understanding of nature, spirituality. We also lost an ecclesiastical system that was based on monasteries rather than bishops. The Roman system was a bishop system, and you know, and it became under the empire a political system. The Celtic system didn't really have bishops. They had monasteries and they had abbots, and so the way a community gathered was a community around a monastery, like the island of Iona, for example, gathering around the abbey at Iona. And that was the way Christian community was done. So it was a much more prayerful, you know, a diocese is a political community. A monastery is a covenanted faith community. And so we moved from that vision of a community to a much more political sense of a community. And we've had to live with that ever since. So that's just a little way into this tension between rigorism and laxism as it's existed in Christianity, really from Jesus's day until the present day, but also especially around the Celtic Christianity and around the Pelagius versus Augustine thing. So because the Pelagius chapter that Newell gives us is a chapter about Pelagius's argument with Augustine. And I want to say a couple things about Pelagius that aren't really in Newell's chapter, and then go on to just say something about Pelagius's ideas and how we can find a way to incorporate them in our own piety. Pelagius came to Rome in the early 5th century. In 410, the Goths sacked Rome, and England, where Pelagius was from, was experiencing a weakening of Roman church control. So if you imagine yourself in Rome in 410 or in Northern Africa, which is where Augustine was, Pelagius came from Britain to Rome, and he came to a community that was kind of like the United States in 2020, 2021, both, you know, ravaged by all kinds of political discontent and the pandemic. Pelagius came into a community that was very distraught because of the suffering, the burning of Rome and the suffering they had experienced at the hands of the Goths. It was a very nervous empire. Pelagius was a monk. And he had an extremely ascetic view of life. He was not in some ways. If you didn't know that he was a Celtic monk, you might think he was a kind of more easygoing guy than he was. But he was a pretty rigorous guy in his understanding of the demands of Christian moral life. And his teaching was essentially a series of exhortations to be better, to behave better, to do good. And I say that because he gathered around him in Rome a bunch of very influential Roman lay Christians who were highly attracted to his message. And he got in the way of St. Augustine, the Bishop of Hippo. Now, St. Augustine isn't quite the villain, I don't think, that John Philip Newell makes him out to be. Although I will admit that he kind of jumped on Pelagius without actually having read what Pelagius wrote, kind of like a student writing a bad term paper. He attacked Pelagius for reports of things that Pelagius had written, but not because he'd actually read those things himself. Now, Augustine had just gone through what we call the Donatist controversy, which was one of the great rigorous laxist controversies in early Christianity. The Donatists were people that said, you know, what happened when you, you know, in the Roman Empire, Christians were persecuted because they wouldn't agree that Caesar was God. They wouldn't sort of swear allegiance to Caesar. And in the persecutions in the Roman Empire, a lot of Christians, including a lot of clergy, recanted and went and swore allegiance to Caesar and swore allegiance to him being a god. And then after the persecution was over, they came back and said, okay, I'd like my job back, and I'd like to be back being a priest in good standing. And the Donatists were saying, no, you can't come back. And all the sacraments that you perform, the communion services, the weddings, whatever, the ordinations, they're all invalid. And so all those people need to be remarried. All those people need to be reordained. And that became a gigantic fight. And Augustine was the big opponent of that group. He said, no, we may not let them back to being functioning priests, but we're going to say that the intention of the church was that those things were valid when they were done. And so we're not going to invalidate everything that they did. The integrity of the celebrant does not determine the validity of the sacrament. That was one of the things Augustine stood for, and Augustine won. And that was a win for the laxists, who said, let's try to keep the community together, rather than the rigorists who said, we need to expel everybody who sinned. Well, so when Augustine saw Pelagius, and he saw Pelagius's ideas about human perfectibility, and that, you know, if you will the good, you can do it. Augustine saw Pelagius as another kind of rigorous Donatist. And so he opposed Pelagius, and he put the bad rap on Pelagius. I'm not defending Augustine's argument here. He put the bad rap on Pelagius that Pelagius believed in justification by works, in salvation by works, that you could just do enough good works and get yourself into heaven. That, as John Philip Newell says, that's not what Pelagius ever said, but that's what Pelagianism came to mean in the church. And that came to be essentially equated with justification by works. Now, there's been a long tradition in Christianity, in the New Testament itself, about whether you were saved by faith or saved by works. Paul says, we are saved by faith alone, apart from works of law. That's, you know, in Romans, that's the basis of sort of Calvinism and all kinds of rigorous, orthodox understandings of salvation by faith. But James, Jesus's own brother, in his letter says, and I had a professor in seminary who said, I'm a Christian because Jesus's own brother believed it. He said, I have a brother, and it would take a lot for me to believe that my brother was the Son of God. So if Jesus's own brother believed it, I believe it. Well, James in his epistle says, faith without works is dead. So there's long been this argument in Christianity about the relationship between faith and works in our salvation. And Pelagius, unfortunately, walked right into that and got an opponent who was a hardliner on the justification by faith thing. So what I want to say is that it's important for us to understand that Pelagius is arguing for good works because he believes that that human nature is naturally good, that the world, he's a kind of a real idealistic progressive, that the world is savable, the world is reparable, it is not fallen in the way that Augustine wants to say it is. It is not irreparably lost. It is a world that can be repaired and saved in the here and now by our good works. And so he exhorts us to very high ethical understanding of how we should behave. So that's what Pelagius is really saying. And it comes out of this monastic ascetic vision of the good life as a life dedicated to good works. How much time do I have before I need to wrap up? Do I have like 5-10 minutes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So I want to say a few more things about Pelagius, but I just want to highlight this thing about the Roman Empire and why this mattered so much. One of the reasons the Romans didn't like the early Christians was because we established this group of, if you read the book of Acts, and you think about the martyrship of Stephen, the first Christian martyr, early on in the Christian tradition, we established a group of people, an ordained ministry called the deacons. And Stephen was one of the first deacons. And we established the deacons because we needed a group of people not only to assist the bishops in administering communion, but we needed a group of people that would reach out to and help the what we called in the Bible the widows and orphans, that we needed a kind of social service agency. Roman culture was laissez-faire capitalism at its worst before it even existed. If you were poor or ill or widowed or maimed in battle or a slave, that's the place in the cosmos you deserved. And you didn't deserve any help from anybody. And the deacons were the first, I would say, social service agency in the world. And they went around on behalf of the church, feeding the poor, visiting the prisoners, visiting the sick, and bringing women who had no social status because they were widows back into the fold of the community. So we were countercultural from the very beginning in this deep way of actually working to help people who were up against it. And in some ways, Pelagius was calling people back to that kind of a vision Christian social service. That in other words, the church at its best, in Pelagius's view, should actually be helping real poor people, real sick people, by giving them money and food and assistance. And Augustine too, and I'm a fan of Augustine in many ways as a theologian. The Confessions of St. Augustine is one of the great spiritual autobiographies ever written. But I'll admit that he got this one wrong. Pelagius and the Celtic monks were on the side of when rich people died, they wanted to just distribute their money to the poor directly. When rich people died to Augustine, he wanted just to take their estates and give their money to the church so that the income would sustain the work of the church. And that's became the way the church did it. So what Pelagius is doing in his whole thing about good works is in the service of a vision of the church really being in direct service to the people that are up against it. And I have to say that the churches I know, including Trinity Church in Santa Barbara and the churches I've served over the course of my life that really get what following Jesus is about, are the churches that really sort of try to live out Pelagius's vision of direct service to people who are up against it. So I want to just highlight and then pose a couple of questions for your groups. There are five areas that John Philip Newell highlights as the fivefold focus of Pelagius's teaching. And the first is the sacredness of the human soul. And he emphasizes that there are sort of three kinds of grace. It's not that Pelagius doesn't believe in grace. He does believe in grace. What he doesn't believe is that somehow, because of the sin of Adam, that the soul of the human being is irrevocably corrupt. What he believes is that the human soul is the beneficiary, that we are all the beneficiaries of the grace of nature. We've been placed here in nature. We are part of nature. We are the beneficiaries of the grace of illumination and he's a great believer in meditative prayer, monastic style of meditative prayer. And he believes that the soul can be illuminated by the spirit. And he's a believer in the grace of mercy, that we can be forgiven, that we can move forward into new life after our forgiveness. Pelagius is secondly a believer in the sacredness of nature. And again, Roman Christianity was terrified of pantheism and of a pagan kind of nature worship, because they saw any kind of ascription of holiness to nature as a return to kind of pagan idolatry ways. But quite rightly, Pelagius recalls us to an earlier vision, Genesis 1:26-28. God created human beings in their own image, and he made us stewards of the creation. And Pelagius calls for an equitable use of the earth's resources. Now, he wasn't in his day thinking so much about climate change. He was thinking again about the equitable distribution of food and money to the poor and the hungry. Pelagius thirdly believed in the sacredness of what Newell calls spiritual practice and specifically in the idea of anamkara, of the soul friend. There is, in fact, an anamkara fellowship now that is a kind of monastic order for people it's for lay people and ordained people. I have several friends in that fellowship, and it is based on the idea of a soul friend and spiritual practice as kind of spiritual direction in community and in relationship. That is really one of the great graces of Celtic spirituality. And that's had an actual great resurgence in a contemporary Christian faith and practice. And fourthly, Newell is a great believer in the sacredness of what he calls human wisdom. And it's interesting how much these I used to be an English teacher. And now if you read Beowulf or any of those early English epics, they're almost always focused on the Old Testament, on the Hebrew Bible. Similarly, Pelagius much more was drawn to Job as a kind of figure of early Hebrew Bible wisdom, and the idea of Job as someone who, through his suffering, achieves a kind of wisdom and a kind of a closeness with God, a kind of friendship with God, that is a kind of template for the way you and I can achieve a kind of wisdom. And finally, what Newell calls the fifth one is the sacredness of compassion. I mean, this almost sounds like the fivefold way of Buddhism in a way. And again, it's not what you believe about Jesus, but rather becoming like Jesus. I have a friend I used to do some teaching with, who used to say that we become what we attend to. And, you know, if we attend to, you know, advertising and all of the false trinkets of Western culture, we become that. If we attend to Jesus and we attend to Jesus as he sort of lives out the baptized life in the Gospels, we over time become that. And so for Pelagius, it's not so much what you think abstractly about Jesus or what the great Alan Jones calls the religion about Jesus. It's rather the religion of Jesus. And I agree with Alan Jones and with Pelagius here that, you know, for the course of recorded history and much of my lifetime, we Christians have been fighting about what we say about Jesus. Is how is he divine? And how is he human? And is he divine and human in an oil and water mixture kind of way, or in some kind of weird magical other kind of way, or in some kind of, you know, and one of the things the Celts say was, no, he really suffered. So he wasn't God. He wasn't a God man pretending to suffer. He really suffered. But Orthodox Christianity has never finally given a satisfactory answer to this in the intellectual terms of our own day. And what Newell says and what Pelagius says and what someone like Alan Jones would say and what I would say is it's time for us Christians, you know, and even Marcus Borg and John Dominic Cross, it's time for us Christians to stop fighting about the religion over the religion about Jesus and come to some understanding of the religion of Jesus, that we want to sort of, we want to have a relationship with the one Jesus calls his father in the way that Jesus did. And we want to be part of a missional community that like Jesus's community of his companions is able to survive times of privation and imperial oppression by works of compassionate love and justice with each other. So Augustine emphasized human sin, I think, because he had a profound experience of delivery from his own sinfulness, but also because he had a vision of a lax church where the wheat and the tares could exist together until the final harvest. Pelagius emphasized a vision of human goodness because he believed that the human being and the world are perfectible, and that real justice and real equitable distribution of God's resources was possible here and now. So what I want to say, and then I'll sort of send you off with a couple of questions, is I think that Jesus's style of compassionate living is an alternative to this imperial vision of oppression, and that we can recover that vision of compassionate mutuality, living together, not necessarily in community. We can be householders, but we can sort of be householders living as itinerants. And that's one of the great attractions, I think, of monastic Christianity. It's not that we're all going to drop and sell our cars and sell our houses and move into monasteries, but we can adopt monastic styles, rules of life, and monastic styles of daily prayer and daily meditation that can bring us together into a kind of soul friendship, a kind of anamkara that can approach what Jesus and his companions lived as an alternative style of living in the first century. And secondly, I think this Celtic emphasis on human sacredness is a warrant for us Christians to act on behalf of all marginalized and suffering people. And I think this Celtic understanding of the sacred earth can really help us correct what I would call an institutional misreading of the Bible. If you go after this and read Psalm 104, you will have no doubt that there is nature mysticism in the scriptures. We have edited it out of our understanding of the Bible for all kinds of imperial and political, and I would say economic reasons. But it's time for us to reapproach our own understanding within our scriptural tradition of the appropriate way of understanding nature as what Sally McFaig calls the body of God, of the earth as the body of God. And I think that Celtic spirituality and specifically the teaching of Pelagius can help us do that. So finally, I got two questions for you. One of them is, how might you re-examine and reappropriate theological truths that you always were told were heresies? My friend Ann Howard, when we were chatting yesterday online, said, you know, Pelagius was always her favorite heretic. I've always been told that certain ideas were bad ideas. Christianity is essentially a 2000 year history of the Orthodox suppressing real truths. We suppressed, you know, what Elaine Pagels called the Gnostic Gospels. There's a lot of authentic Jesus sayings. There's a lot of authentic goodness in Gnosticism that we suppressed because, the so-called Orthodox wanted to sort of kill that. So how can re-examine and appropriate things we were always told were heretical and not even worth considering and bring back into our understanding of theological truth? And secondly, how can we Christians reappropriate and incorporate theological truths from outside our own tradition? You know, I've always felt that if we're going to have some sort of interfaith unity, we're going to have it because of prayer practice. We're not going to get it because we and the Buddhists and the Muslims are all going to sit down and agree on some sort of abstract definition of the divine. But we're going to get it because we understand that Zen Buddhism and Sufi have a lot to tell us about authentic ways to pray. And that centering prayer as a Christian tradition has an authentic thing to tell other traditions about ways to pray. So how can we Christians incorporate theological truths or prayer practices from other traditions, or yoga, for example, that can help us really experience the truth of our own tradition? And finally, again, remember Columba's tears. These things, this is something beautiful, and I hold it as sacred. And it's from a sacred place in Celtic spirituality. And the great John O'Donohue said before he died that one of the things Christians really need to do is reappropriate place as an important factor in our own spirituality. And so as you think about Columba's tears and you think about the sacredness of place in your own spiritual life, think about ways in which we Christians and other thoughtful religious people of goodwill can be faithful stewards of the places that God has given us the grace to inhabit and where God calls us to redeem and perfect a nature that is good and gracious and beautiful and at our disposal to love and protect. Those are my thoughts. And off you go.